Okay, here's what it's time for. It's time for a quiz. So I want you to put all your papers and notes away, get out a instrument to write with. Normally they would say something like a number two soft lead pencil, right? And so have you heard those words before? Some of you probably heard them recently. Yeah, some of us, it's been a while. But nevertheless, that same thing, it's time for a quiz. Do you remember what it used to do to your stomach? Even if it was, well, here is a cartoon. It smells like a quiz, a pop quiz. Here's a guy named Nate. As a matter of fact, it's Big Nate. Of course, we got a couple of Nates, Nate Stewart, Nate Breitage. We've got some Nates around here that we're aware of. A Big Nate book. Evidently, this is a series coming into class. Look at the teacher's face. I don't know if you can see this up here, but that thing of the stomach turn, the heart jump. Well, I want you to know this morning we are not going to have a pop quiz. But we are going to listen in on a promise. Well, let me ask you this. When you had a quiz, what kind of questions did you prefer? Ones that were like multiple choice? Okay, how about fill in the blank? Not fill in the blank. How about true and false? Was that good? Yeah. Or essay? Oh, low on the line, essay. True and false, you at least had a 50% chance, right? You know, you got 50-50 odds here, even if you're completely unaware. So this morning, what we're going to be looking at, not a pop quiz, but a promise, and a promise that has to do with true or false, and it's in John chapter 4. So I'm going to ask you to turn there to John chapter 4, where we're going to hear some promise that Jesus makes about worship in a context of worship, true or false. Here's Jesus' promise and your choice. John chapter 4, we're going to pick up in John chapter 4 at verse number 21. So if you have your Bible or if you have your app, I'd like you to go there. John chapter 4, we're going to zero in on verse 21. And as we're doing this, I want you to know that this takes place. Jesus' promise is given, it's announced in a conversation. It's a conversation that's taking place at lunch break. It's a conversation that's taking place at a lunch rest break near the water fountain. And it's between a woman and Jesus. Just to verify that all I'm telling you is true, look with me in John chapter 4 at verse 3. It's talking about Jesus here. You can see that in context, verses 1 and 2. And he, Jesus, left Judea and departed again for Galilee. Now, if you remember the outlay of the Holy Land, the Palestine, especially in the time of Jesus, there was Judea down here in the north. And then immediately to the south, it was in the south, and immediately to the north, there was Samaria, and then immediately to the north again, there was Galilee. So Jesus is traveling here from the south up to the north, and it says this, he left Judea, verse 3, and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. That's in the middle. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, weary as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Now, it was 6 a.m. That was the first hour. That was when the Jewish day started. So we are about at high noon when the sun is at the pinnacle. It's at its highest point there in the sky, and it's warm out, and they're traveling, and Jesus takes a break. You know, he came in the flesh, and as coming in the flesh, he experienced everything that we do, wearying. And he sits down by the water fountain, and a woman comes there. A woman comes to draw water there at the well. And as she does, he enters into a conversation with her about the water, etc. And that's where we pick up our text at verse number 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth." Worship, true and false. Jesus' promise, and as he makes clear here, your choice relative to this promise. Jesus is talking to this woman at Sychar, which is just about 2 miles north of Jacob's Well. It's a modern-day city that's called Askar. And in that modern-day community, there is recognition of the closeness of Jacob's Well. Now, this town sits just outside of the mountain called Gerizim. There's Mount Gerizim. And that Mount Gerizim is the mount that she talks about, on this mount. So, this morning, as we take a look at this, worship true and false, it's not a quiz, but believe me, this is one that you want to get right. We're going to talk about worship to God, for people, through Christ. We're going to talk about worship true and false, because that's the way Jesus talks about it here. And your choice to be engaged in true worship or something less, something false. Now, we're going to talk about it in this way. To God, worship is important. We're going to see how important here. For people, worship is true or false, and we're going to see how Jesus lays that out to her, and not only for her, but for people thereafter. As a matter of fact, when he says to her, "you," he says it in the plural, for more people than her alone. For people, worship is true or false. And finally, through Christ, worship is genuinely experienced. And we're going to see how that is to take place. So this is what we're going to be looking at this morning. And the place for us to begin here, the best place to start is how the worship conversation comes up with this woman. How is it that Jesus gets to the point of talking with her about worship at a lunch break near the drinking fountain? How does he get there? Well, if you notice with me in chapter 4, we've already seen that it's at lunchtime around the drinking fountain. And Jesus speaks to this woman about a thirst that's not quenched in her life. A thirst that's not satisfied, that is ongoing for her, not only for her, but for all the rest of the people who exist on the planet. There's a thirst. There's something more. There's something else. There's just not contented. And he talks to her by this avenue. Look with me at verse 13. Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But," verse 14, "whoever drinks of the water that I will give will never be thirsty again." Now, that's part of this promise we're going to be looking at. It is a promise about satisfaction, a satisfaction that comes from within. The water, verse 14, that I will give him or her, since he's talking to a woman here, I will give him or her, will become in him or her a spring of water welling up to eternal life, a life that goes on and is continuous, knowing it in both directions, eternity past and eternity future. This is what he's promised, a satisfaction of life that is coming from within and goes on, grasping and reigning in life, as the New Testament says, from the past to the total future, all of it. And the woman has an interest. Verse 15, the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come to draw water." Now, with her interest, Jesus then presses a point about her involvement. He talks about her personal life, very personal, and some of the dark, secretive things of her life that she really wasn't wanting to talk about at all. As a matter of fact, she so doesn't want to talk about this that she immediately begins to change the subject here. She begins a switch. She puts a spin on this. Have you ever had anybody do that to you? You're talking to them, and they don't want to go here, so they spin to change the subject. Well, that's exactly what she does, and that's where our text picks up, verse 19. The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, Mount Gerizim, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Now, this worship thing, even though this is a switch, is exactly what Jesus wants to focus on with her. This is where he wanted to go. So he is going to talk with her about this. So, to God, worship is important. Jesus begins to point out how important it is to God by saying to her, "The Father is seeking people to worship him." Notice how he answers her. Verse 21. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me." It's an appeal. Trust me on this. Will you trust me? Trust me. Trust me. Believe me. The hour is coming when neither on this mountain, Mount Gerizim, nor in Jerusalem at the temple will you worship the Father. You, and he's talking here in a plural you, you worship what you do not know, her and other people. We, referring to himself and the Jewish people, worship what we know for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people, the Father is seeking to worship him. The Father is seeking people to worship him. This idea of worshiping him, this idea of him seeking worship of him, what this is saying to us is God, with desire, looks to find people who have this. Well, let me pause for a moment right here and give a little context from the Bible of the idea of worship. Worship is in the Bible from the beginning of it right to the very end. From the book of Genesis to Revelation, this is talked about. And various words are used for worship. The one that she uses here is a word that means to kiss towards. It's kind of like that kind of thing. It's that you have a expression of admiration, an expression of, that's the term that she, it's kind of used for a dog. You know, a dog doesn't go, but a dog comes up. Have you ever had a dog come up and lick your hand? It's just, and that's their kiss towards. And that's what was used. That's where this term kind of comes from, the dog doing that. Of course, this isn't about dogs, it's about people. And the point that I'm making, that word isn't the only one that's used for worship. There are other ones, and I'm not going to go through them. I'm just going to kind of bring this together by saying all of them, all of the words that are used for worship refer to holding a value, a sense of worth towards something or someone or some place, a person, place, or thing, that there is a sense of value, of admiration, of appreciation. And that sense, that sentiment, that holding of this value gets expressed in a way of service to this. Let me give you an example. There's a guy that I worked with while I was going through seminary. And while I was going through seminary working, we would talk at the lumber yard. And he told me of how much he valued or appreciated vacation. So much, and here's his service to it, that every paycheck he would take set amount of money, a designated amount, and put it aside so that he could have his vacation. That was a sense of admiration, of value, of worth that he held for this, that he gave service to it, actually put a dollar value on this so much every paycheck. Some people do that with Christmas, right? Yep. Some people do that. But it's not confined to a thing like vacation. Some people value a car, and they do that. As a matter of fact, they carry debt in order to do that. As a matter of fact, most cars are that way. Or a person. And there is such a value for this person that I Well, here's what's always said. If you're going to have a relationship, you've got to invest in it, right? You've got to. It's got to be invested in. That is the idea that's throughout the scriptures of worship. A sense of, well, the English word worship comes from a compound word. It comes from the old English word for worth or value, and then ship added to it as being a state or condition that you're in. I'm in a state or condition of carrying a sense of value or worth for this thing. Now, we're talking about the worth-ship that we hold and express in some form of service to and for God. That's what we're talking about. And what is the degree of value and service that we are to hold for God? As a matter of fact, it's the first priority direction that we get from God. You know it. It's called the first commandment. You shall, say this with me, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. That's the value. That's it. That's it. And it's what's carried in us and expressed in serving, a service to God, expressing that value which we hold. Now, that's where this woman talks to Jesus, saying, where does that take place for us? This to God, does it take place? I mean, correctly here, prophet, correctly. Where does this take place? Does it take place here on Mount Gerizim? Now, remember, this woman, according to verse 7, is a Samaritan. It's a Samaritan woman. She lives in this area. And there's a history here. There's a history between the Jews and the Samaritans. It's a racial tension issue. And it's like real big. You see, what happened in 722, the Assyrians swept down and they took the Israelites, the Israelis. Israelites is kind of the biblical term. Israelis is the way we call them today. He took those people and he took them into exile from Assyria. And they also brought from other places, other foreign nations over which the Assyrians had domination, they brought people to this area of Israel. And they forced the eradication of this racism by forcing marriages and intermingling and that kind of, they forced it to happen. And so, and you'd like to read about this, you can. It's in 2 Kings chapter 17, the whole chapter, verses 1 through 6. So what happened when they returned is that when they returned from exile, the Jews looked at these Samaritans who were half Jew and half some other pagan nation race, and they looked at them with disdain. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't let them worship at the temple. And so the Samaritans made their own. There on Mount Gerizim, they built a temple to worship God, the God that they saw in the first five books of the Bible, because that's the only ones that they bought as valued, the first five books of the Bible, and they worshiped him there. So when this Samaritan woman comes to Jesus and asks him this question, she's talking about something that has years and years, centuries of racial tension since 722 BC and thereafter to Jesus' day. That's a little deep. That's a little deep. So, she says, to turn the attention away from this topic of her dark, secretive life, she turns it to what's correct in worship, what's correct in blowing a kiss towards God. Is it correct that we do it here, as the Samaritans say, or in Jerusalem, like you Jews say? And that's where Jesus gives the response to God. It's not here. It's not there. A time is coming, and God is seeking it now. A people to worship. It's that important to God. He's seeking people here. And I want you to know, this wasn't a brand new idea. This had been said over and over and over, that God is seeking people. There are some passages, the eyes of the Lord look down from heaven to see if there's anybody who understands, if there's anybody who seeks God. 2 Chronicles 6, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth. They're looking for people. And Proverbs chapter 15, verse 3, the eyes of the Lord are in every place. He is seeking. He is looking. This is where it's at. God looked down, even the book of Genesis, like they bought, and he saw the wickedness of men. He was looking at them, seeking where they were out. In Psalm 30, 139, you search me, you know my path, my lying down, my rising up. You know it, you are intimately acquainted with all my ways. And I want you to know that this is done on a scale of all people, but it's done individually with all people. God is looking, seeking all from all people, but individually relative to you. You know my path. You are intimately acquainted with my, all of my ways. And that brings us to the next point here, and it's this. The Father knows where people are at with him on this. He knows where they're at. He's seeking with desire some who will be in this state of worship towards him, and he knows where the people are at. The passage says it like this. He is looking for such people. People who are characteristically in this condition, this state, to worship him. He is looking for people in that state. As a matter of fact, we have all the passages that I just noted, and in all of those passages, all of those passages, God talks about knowing where the person is. He knows where every individual is, and he knows where all people are. Here, let me show you this. There it is. The eyes of the Lord look down from heaven to see if there is any who would understand, if there's any who seek God. They have all turned aside. Together, they have become unprofitable. There is none who understand. Now listen to this. No, not one. It's individual. Also, 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 19, the Lord, eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout all the earth so that God will show himself strong to anyone whose heart is loyal to him. Proverbs 15:3, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. He knows the point of all this. He knows. He saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. He knows. He knows. You know me. You know my path. You know my thoughts from afar. God knows you. He knows where you are at on this. Worship is important to him. He's seeking it out, and he knows where you're at. Now, I want to ask a question here concerning worship being important to God, a kind of worship that we value him, we honor, respect, admire, adore him. Why is that so big to him? What's the big deal about that? He wants it to be a condition where we so value him that we serve. We give service to this value, like a person does for a vacation, like a person does for a car, servicing it, paying for it, keeping. Why? What? I mean, doesn't everybody want to be worshipped? What do you say? Doesn't everybody want to be valued, appreciated, honored, respected, admired, even adored? Don't we? So is this kind of some self-centered thing with God? Well, the Bible tells us that God has so arranged the best for people that we are to give honor to whom honor is due. Romans chapter 13, verse 7. Give honor to whom honor is due. So when we honor a person who is achieved or accomplished, we're actually behaving in line with God, because he says, give honor to whom honor is due. Give respect to whom respect is due. The Bible tells us that we are to honor the king. Give respect to the king. And all people. That's Acts, where he says that to us. The Bible tells guys, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, honor your wives. Live with them in an understanding way, giving them honor, giving honor to the wife. Respect, appreciation, admiration, value, a sense of worth that you live with. Wives are to Ephesians chapter 5, respect their husbands. Children are to honor their parents, Ephesians chapter 6, 1, which is the first command of God, which has a promise. And every one of these expressions of honor is for our good. He says that to children, that it'll go well with you and you'll live long on the earth. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. So honor your father and your mother. Now, the whole point here is that we give honor to the person to the degree and to the place and the position that they're in according to what's due them. Okay, let's think about God. What's his place? Creator, sustainer, originator. What's his position? He maintains everything, keeps it going. So the honor we give to God is according to the same honor that he has expressed to every person. What's due them? And what's due God when we fully understand this is to love him with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. And what's due a neighbor is to love your neighbor like what? Like you love you. Like you love you. Do to them like you would have done to you in such a circumstance. This is the big deal about God. Now I want to add this. For people, this worship of God can be true or false. It's not true if a person doesn't know God. Look at this. He says to the woman, verse 21, "Believe me, woman." Then again in verse 22, "You worship what you do not know." Her worship is proving to be false, not true, because she didn't know what she worshiped. The Samaritans only took the first five books of the Bible and junked all the rest. And the God they came up with, just like Psalm 22 tells us, is a God who many people think is just like them. There's a guy who wrote a book that's called God Has a Name. And in the introduction to this book, John Mark, what's his last name, Alita, do you remember? Carmi? That's it, Comer. This guy wrote a book, and in the beginning of this, he says that he has a friend who teaches up in Minnesota, and he teaches in a Bible college, and when he teaches about the person of God, he starts out by asking a person, "So, what do you like? What do you don't like? What kind of personality do you have?" And ask them about them. And then he goes on and says, "You know, God has personality too. What do you think God's personality? What is he like? What is he not like?" And he said, surprisingly, over and over, these exactly line up. God likes what I like. God doesn't like what I don't like. God is a Republican like I am. God's a Democrat, like we're supposed to be, like I am. And it's amazing how this lines up. Because of not knowing God, we fabricate in our own thinking what he's like. And that is not true worship. When the person who you're worshiping, you really don't know. You worship what you don't know. They had this to the great eternal being. And they didn't know him. They didn't. It's not true. They worship what they did not know. And that 2 Kings 17 just points that out so clearly. It's not true when it doesn't have salvation. That's what Jesus says here. Notice, you worship what you do not know. We Jews worship what we know, for salvation is out of the Jews. This rescue, this thing of being confident that you're going to heaven through the death of Jesus Christ, paying for our sins, his burial and his resurrection, this salvation through the Messiah, which comes out of the Jews, if you don't have it, it's not true worship. It's always been off. It's not correct. The woman gets this, that it comes through the Messiah, because look at what she says to him at verse number 25. The woman says to her, "Sir, I know that Messiah is coming, the one who is called the Christ. And when he comes, he's going to make everything clear to us." Jesus' point is that if you do not have the salvation that comes through the Jewish Messiah, this is not true worship. You have never appropriately valued and adored God with a service that loves Him without being saved. If you're not rescued, it can't happen. Why? Well, we'll look at that in a moment. Finally, he says, it is true when it's according to Jesus, because he goes on to say, believe me, that hour is coming and is now here. It's now. I want you to pick up this last point, then I want to show you a picture. True worship is genuinely experienced when the worship promise, which is for here and now, when the worship promise, here's the picture. This is my backyard. This is a spot in my backyard. You know, this spot was there when, about a month ago, I disassembled the inflatable pool that we had up for the summer. Since we're about out of September, it was about the beginning of September, and I pulled this pool liner and I set it in the yard to get the container to store it in. And so the night, because I set this out afternoon, late afternoon, evening, the night that I had that setting on the lawn to get the container, a rainstorm came through. And this rainstorm absolutely changed the dry, parched ground that we had and made it vibrant and alive. And my pool sitting there, the ground underneath it, completely missed that rain. I pulled the pool off and the water runs out and it, and right, you know, this picture was from yesterday. Point that I'm making is I missed the opportunity, at least for that ground. The worship of God is now. It's the opportunity now, and it will be in the future. True worship is genuinely experienced when the worship promise is seen for now and the future. The worship promise is that you experience worship in spirit. Spirit is what we are inside. Spirit, the word means breath, and it comes from when God breathed life into us. And we became living souls. It's breath. So what he's talking about is worshiping in spirit is that our life inside, which we derive from God, carries this value towards Him, and it carries this value when the Spirit of God comes in to our spirit. This is being born of the Spirit. This is worship in our spirit by the Spirit of God. Paul or John talked about this in Revelation chapter 1. He said, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And he's talking about this expression of worship where his Spirit intentionally engaged in expressing to God through his Spirit thanksgiving, honor, respect, adoration, admiration. That is worship in spirit. It has a double meaning, the human spirit with the divine spirit. That's when true worship is experienced. And he says, true worship is done in truth. It's done in real time. It's done according to the Word of God, like we've just looked at the truth of it. And worship is a must. Notice what he says. Verse 24, God is spirit. It must be in your spirit by his spirit. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. This has to be present and engaged in. Now, I want you to know that a lot of times we will mouth words. Thank God for a new birth where his spirit is in us. But it's better. It's better when we engage our spirit with his spirit to worship him. Psalm 103 talks about that. Praise the Lord. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Now, I want to end this thing by talking about one final point. And it's this. This is definitely for our good and for God's glory. I want to give an illustration here. My wife babysits a guy named Abraham. Now, this Abraham is not the Abraham from the Old Testament, you understand. It's not the patriarch, though he's named after the patriarch. This Abraham is currently about 3 years old. And this Abraham is quite a stout three-year-old, pretty strong, pretty self-willed, pretty determined. And my wife is, she is not a good wrestling match for him, okay? Because he can kind of get going and wanting and pushing and shoving and trying to get away. So what she does is she appeals to his heart. And she talks to Abraham and interacts and treats Abraham in such a way that I want Meemaw. I love Meemaw. Where is Meemaw? I want Meemaw. So that he, from honor and respect, admiration, listens to her when he runs out by parked cars and she gives direction. When she, on that highway number 3 that runs by our house, takes off outside because of this honor, she's no wrestling match for him. He listens. He follows. He obeys. That is the good of our worship. That God, having us by the heart with respect and honor, because he made us and he rescued us and he provides for us and he loves us to such a degree that he is willing to die to have us, God, because he has us by the heart. We, with all our soul, mind, strength, do him service. Folks, that's genuine worship. That's for now. That's what we're here for. Join me, and thus please.